Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines, with 4,000 flights to 250 cities in some 40 countries around the world every day. It's easy to book your next flight at AA.com. American Airlines knows why you fly. I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and I want to take you to the top of the world. We're going to Nepal now, and we've got with us a man who wrote The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal, Joe Bindlis. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for inviting me.
Joe, you mentioned in the introduction to The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal, you were lured by a sense of quiet, both inner and outer. What did you mean by that when we think of Nepal?
I mean, well, I think it's partly the when people think of sort of a spiritual retreat. I mean, being up at the sort of the highest mountains in the world, surrounded by the silence and ringing of temple bells, is exactly what that means. And also the sense of peace and quiet that physically comes from just being so far from any other people. I mean, there are places in Nepal we can only get to on foot, where you could be hundreds of miles away from the nearest electric line or telephone. So you really can get back to what you're thinking about things.
It's so far away from where we're all sitting right now, but try to paint a picture. Where were you in Nepal where you can remember this powerful sense of inner and outer quiet?
I think probably the most profound for me was when I was quite young, I went backpacking to Nepal, and I started off on one of the established trekking routes, and then just decided to branch off. I had some good maps and a compass, and spent about 14 days just walking across the hills. And I would sleep in the woods sometimes. I would stay in people's houses if people invited me in. I would sometimes sleep into the doorways of temples. And just a feeling of sort of totally being totally unconcerned by the sort of the general worries of the world, the news. It was all irrelevant. It was just living the existence of being there at that particular time was incredibly relaxing.
Wow. Can you still have that kind of magical, footloose and fancy-free travel experience as an older professional travel researcher?
It's possible, but I think as you get older and become and start working, you have to make the extra effort to sort of disconnect from that worrying about the mortgage and everything else at home.
That's a
challenge.
It's
still possible, but it's down to you rather than the place. The place is still the same.
But people who want to and people who are able to, they can still just lose themselves on back trails in Nepal and sleep on the doors of temples.
Absolutely. I mean, and even between very, very famous places, I mean, the road from Kathmandu to Pokhara has half a dozen small towns along it where almost nobody visits, and they are like stepping back 300 or 400 years into Nepali history. They're amazing.
And that's on the road connecting the two main towns in the country.
Absolutely, yeah. But bear in mind, that road has only been open for, I think, since the 1960s.
Wow. Now, that's connecting Kathmandu and Pokhara. You wrote about riding the funky bus, but actually riding on the rooftop. Tell us about that.
Roof riding is hysterical. I mean, they're trying to discourage it slowly because Nepalese feel that it makes them look bad because it's a little bit dangerous. But it's so much fun. I mean, the bags go up there anyway, and if the bus is too crowded down below, it's actually often easier and more comfortable to be on the roof. And you'll be riding up there. Sometimes there'll be livestock on there. Sometimes there'll be chickens, all manner of stuff. You wouldn't believe the things that people put on the roofs of buses. And then you've got the mountains just around you. I mean, if you travel towards Pokhara, there's the mountain of Mount Pokhara, which is just facing you directly in front of you as you come up the valley. It's a perfect pyramid covered in snow at the end of the road.
Riding on rooftops, there's something magical about it. I've actually done it in romantic oak forests of England or whatever. If you can climb up on the roof and let somebody drive slowly, just have the wind in your face and the elements all around you.
It's almost like being on a motorcycle. You're right in amongst all the things you're around. You're not sort of cocooned inside a bus or a train. You're there amongst it all. And Nepal, you can also ride on the roofs of trains in Nepal, and it's one of the last countries in the world where you can do that.
So you just choose, you can have the squalor and everybody is sort of in your social space inside where people are used to having a lot of density. Or if you're a little more physical, you could just climb up onto the rooftop and hang on to the ski rack or something, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, there is this little sort of metal basket on top which holds all the bags and you squeeze it amongst them. And
wow.
You have to be a little bit careful. I mean, if you've got under power lines, you have to remember to duck and things. But everyone else will be ducking too, so.
I'm talking with Joe Bindlis. He's the author to The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal. And Joe, let's get right into the safety issue, because there's a lot of people who are aficionados of Nepal, but you read about the Maoist uprising and so on. And of course, in 2001, the prince that gunned down, 10 members of the royal family. Give us a quick update on that event and what's happened since and the safety issues and concerns for travelers.
Well, basically, I mean, King Gunendra, who was the current monarch, who's recently been stripped of his sort of his executive powers, sort of came to power as a result of this this sort of terrible sort of royal disaster where the members of the royal family were shot, and proceeded to become a sort of completely autocratic ruler and overrule sort of the democratic decisions of the people. And Nepal has an interesting situation because most of the wealth is concentrated entirely in the cities, and people in the countryside have very little power or wealth. And so the Maoist uprising started and very quickly gained support by the people in the countryside. And eventually they were able to force the king to return power to the elected parties. And now the Maoists are disarming and have signed a peace deal and are planning to become part of the normal government.
So do you see the Maoists as a positive thing then for the people?
It's hard to say. I mean, in the long term they might be, but with all insurgencies, I mean, no matter what sort of the idealism behind it, the actual process is very brutal, and both the Nepali army and the Maoists did some terrible things to people who really weren't involved in it at all. So I think now it's stopped, it has the opportunity to be good for the country, but what was happening is a terrible, terrible 10 years.
So they've had sort of a smoldering civil war between the Maoists and the Royalists.
It effectively was a civil war, and it was largely ignored by sort of the Western media in favor of the more high-profile events in the Middle East, for example.
So you're saying it was a civil war?
Not on the scale of some, but I mean, it was 12,000 Nepalis died at least.
Yeah.
So it was a very serious thing for the country. But foreigners were never really a risk or a target for either side. Even during the height of it, people were still visiting.
Is the goal of the Maoists to make the monarchy more like a constitutional monarchy in Europe?
Absolutely. I mean, that's basically what's happening. Is that the King Gunendra is now a figurehead monarch,
okay,
and the power has been returned to the elected prime minister and the political parties.
Okay, so that's, in effect, the Maoists are having their way. They're not turning into some sort of a, you know, Maoist, what we think of in China.
Well,
but
it doesn't seem to be. There doesn't seem to be a sort of a goal of making an idealist Maoist state. It does seem to be sort of give choice back to the people.
To give more democracy and temper the power of the royal family.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the king will be a figurehead like in Norway or something like this.
Well, sure. I mean, cause the previous king was greatly admired. I mean, a lot of Nepalis regard the king as an incarnation of Vishnu, the Hindu god.
Right.
So it's quite a sort of important thing for Nepalis to have this figurehead of a king, but they don't necessarily want the king to be making decisions which affect their sort of poverty and their lifestyle so badly.
But the country is still called the Kingdom of Nepal
at the moment. Yeah, I imagine probably if things keep on proceeding, there probably will be plans to change that.
And then the airline, the Royal Nepali Airlines.
I think at the moment it's so fresh. It was only the 9th of November that the ceasefire was officially signed.
Okay. So it's just sort of unfolding. But just bottom line, safety for travelers, what do you think?
I mean, it's probably safer now than it's been for 10 years. I mean, the rebels have signed a ceasefire and the UN is stepping in to monitor the weapons. So it wasn't actually that unsafe previously either.
Now, if there is anger, is it lashed out at foreigners that are coming in, as in some countries, or can a tourist kind of...
Absolutely not. I mean, foreigners aren't really sort of considered a benefit by both the rebels and the government. So, I mean, even during the height of the insurgency, trekkers were able to trek in Maoist-controlled areas. They just had to pay an extra tax.
So the Maoists saw that they didn't see them as bringing in evil Western influences. They saw them bringing in modern democratic values and money.
Well, I think not so much values, but just wealth to rural communities, because trekkers are doing what the government wasn't doing, which was bringing money to villages and to remote parts, which the government basically ignored.
That's great. Let's talk just for a minute about Kathmandu, the capital city, because that's the springboard for most people.
It is.
My memory there is this monkey temple. Take me up to the monkey temple.
Well, Swayambhunath is a stunning place. It's built on a conical hill just on the outskirts of town. I mean, you can if you take a road up the back, but the best way to arrive is to come first thing in the morning and walk up this incredibly steep, sort of perilous flight of stone steps, which has been there for hundreds of years. And it's crowded with incredibly aggressive, sort of pampered rhesus macaque monkeys who will mob you and try and steal food from you.
Did you say rhesus attack monkeys?
No, rhesus macaque.
Macaque, because I thought they were rhesus attack monkeys.
Yeah.
I went up there and they literally grabbed my glasses from me and I was like hostage.
Yeah, they're, I mean, but because they're venerated as of a religious symbol by the Nepali Hindus, they're basically treated like spoiled children and they're allowed to get away with absolute murder. So there are stories of them actually learning to steal cameras and things off tourists and hold them until they're given food and then they'll return them to you. They'll drop them.
You know, I'm talking with Joe Bindless, who writes The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal, and so many of us who've been to Nepal just count it as the greatest travel experience on the face of this planet. And one of the highlights is in Kathmandu, a great city, going up to this monkey temple, and these aggressive, it's just a hive of aggressive monkeys that just know how to push your buttons. And when I'm in Nepal, I remember I just treasured my little digestive biscuits. You know, you get those little packets of munchy biscuits. They're little, kind of like animal crackers without that shape. And they would look at my biscuits, and you'd know this monkey's got his eye on my biscuit, and I would just toss it up in the air.
Carrying food is a very dangerous proposition.
Abandon your biscuits.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, yeah, I mean, I've seen people doing that. I've seen people sort of naively carrying umbrellas that temple and other places where monkeys hang out, and then just like trying to work out why all the monkeys are surrounding them in a huge ring, and if you're throwing the umbrellas in the air and running.
So if you want to get abused by smart monkeys, go to the monkey temple. But when you get up at the top, it's a teeming world of pilgrims and spinning prayer wheels.
It's an incredibly beautiful place. I mean, it's even as a tourist mob, it's just to see the architecture and get the views. It's half the people visiting are there for sort of very personal spiritual reasons. And that's one thing that Nepal delivers sort of more than many other countries around the world, is a sense of incredible belief around you. They're all different religions sort of amassed in Kathmandu.
Ah, it's great. Speaking of religions in Kathmandu, they have the living virgin goddess, the Kumari Deva.
This is quite controversial at the moment. The government's been instructed to look into it, to whether it's an anachronism, which it doesn't have a place in sort of modern society. But basically, a girl is chosen by a series of complex religious rites, and until she reaches puberty, she becomes a living incarnation of a goddess, and she's worshipped and venerated and lives in a special house, which she's only had to be seen by the normal people once a year.
So they pick this pure young girl, and she lives in this little palace, and she never really gets out in the public, and she has her attendants and so on until she reaches puberty. And I remember she sort of comes out onto the balcony a couple times a week or something
this.
And of course, there's a modern approach to this, that we would be abusing this this young girl. When she does reach puberty, then does she go back into the general public?
Yes, she just retires, and then she gets a job, gets married, whatever. Yeah,
wow, so you could actually be married. You could be married to a former living virgin goddess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very surreal concept for us.
But hi, here's my wife. She's
normal.
A former living virgin goddess. That'd be a fun thing at a party.
I imagine they might be a little bit spoiled, but I couldn't confirm that.
I think an interesting interview would be to talk to husbands of former living virgin goddesses. Hey,
long-suffering.
When I look at the cover of your book, I see this guy whose face is just painted with all this ash and white paint. And
the tattoos, yeah.
Describe this guy to me. Tell me what's going on there.
Within Hinduism, it's perfectly accepted you might have a normal job, you might be working in an office, and just one day you decide you're going to follow a spiritual path, and you give up all your material possessions, and you become a wandering ascetic, and you perform religious rites for people in exchange for food, and you basically live entirely off alms and charity, and it's totally accepted. It's considered a perfectly normal thing to do.
So a wandering ascetic, sort of kind of a Hindu monk of some sort, I guess.
And that's effectively monks, but it's like monks used to be, I suppose, in Europe in the sort of 17th century when people literally did give up every possession they had and just live on the street.
Joe, one of the most fascinating, eerie experiences I've ever had when I'm in Nepal is I'm looking into the eyes of these ascetics, these guys that are just caked with paint and seem to be abusing their bodies, and they've got a sort of a peacefulness and a clarity in their eyes. And I look into the eyes and I see an American who's checked out.
Well, it's the smoking charis is quite an important part of the Shivite branch of Hinduism, and so a lot of these guys actually do smoke marijuana to achieve a meditative state, because Lord Shiva was believed to have spent, I think, 10,000 years meditating in the Himalaya and smoking marijuana. So it's part of the religion.
Oh, well, that was my next point about marijuana. But when I look at these guys, I do see guys that you look into their faces, and they could be from the first world or the developing world. They could be from the Himalayas or down in India or something. But they just really, you can't tell where they've been, but you know where they are right now.
They're in a different place. I mean, they're living a sort of a completely different existence, both internally and externally to the rest of us. And I think imagine if you spent your entire time thinking about ideas instead of having to go to work. You're just morning till night. You're thinking about concepts of life and existence.
Do Americans end up in this state in Nepal?
Well, some people do. I mean, Nepal is a famous place where people go and sort of obtain religion of various kinds. And some people take it idly, and some people become very, very sort of personally involved in it. And some people go the whole hog and convert to Buddhism. They become Buddhist monks. They go and sort of spend years in monasteries in the remote parts of the hills.
When I was there, Freak Street was the big hit, and some of the happiest days in my life have been spent on Freak Street. Is that
Freak Street's still there? But it's kind of looking a little bit forlorn these days. All the action's been pulled up towards Tamil now.
But there still is a scene of young backpackers hanging out over there.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, I mean, as you get older, you sort of your attitudes to it change. But it's still an incredibly good, fun place to meet other travellers. I mean, the bars. The party is late. Now, part of it's because a lot of people just come back from trekking, and they're so sort of glad to talk to other people again and enjoy sort of nice food and have some beers, and of course, a lot of people sort of smoke as well. So it's
a great scene,
a party atmosphere as well.
It's the only time in my life where my watch was literally the enemy. I took it off, and it felt like a travesty to have a wristwatch hanging
on
my body.
It's letting go of all those other things and just sort of enjoying where you are is one of the great things that Kathmandu offers. And it's like newspapers. Why would you need to read a newspaper particularly? It's like you can go for a month without seeing what happens back in the Western world, and you haven't missed anything really.
I'm talking with Joe Bindlis. He's the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal. And Joe, it's just great to talk to somebody who's been to Nepal recently. I read in your book that one of the items you want to put on your checklist is a face mask to handle the pollution in Kathmandu. What's the deal there?
A lot of the vehicles are still using, motorbikes still using old two-stroke engines. And they churn out exhaust pollution in incredible volumes. And a lot of the cars and vans, they wouldn't be allowed to be on the roads in a lot of other countries because of the amount of exhaust fumes they produce. So it can be really choking.
Wow.
Which is one of the reasons I always prefer to sort of stick to the old pedestrian streets of the old town where the only vehicles are cycle rickshaws.
Yeah. They still got bicycle rickshaws then?
Yeah, they have. I mean, they're mainly in sort of staffed by these sort of teenage boys who offer helicopter rides where they just ride at full speed through the crowds and everyone has to jump out of the way.
Helicopter rides? You mean that's sort of an adventure sport?
And it doesn't really resemble a helicopter, but it's very exhilarating.
You hop on the bicycle rickshaw, and there's some sort of you tell them you want to go on this ride, and their goal is not to take you somewhere, but take you on a speed ride through the crowds.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just kind of and a lot of the time they want a bit of a tip for sort of pushing the envelope like that. But it's
that'd be worth the tip.
Yeah, no, it's great fun.
Sounds like great fun. All right. Hey, we're in Kathmandu. I'm talking with Joe Bindlis, the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal, and we've got Craig on the line in Wisconsin Dell in Wisconsin. Craig, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Hello, Craig.
Hello. We had been just looking at different options for how to find tour companies or groups in Nepal, and even had come across a group such as, I think the title was Red Spokes. It offered like a mountain bike trek from Kathmandu to Pokhara. But I'm just wondering, is there any way to actually find out what are kind of good, reputable companies for these things? You can find a lot of it, it seems, on the Internet, but I'm just wondering,
sure,
how does one know what one's looking at?
But the best thing to do is talk to someone else who's been with that company. I mean, most companies, if you ask them, will let you talk to some former people who've been on the treks. And in my experience, generally, when you talk to people who've been on these things before, they're normally fairly honest. And so they'll tell you about the highs and the lows as well. I mean, we recommend a couple in the guidebook as well, but it's I also try using the bulletin boards. I mean, Lonely Planet, we have a thing called the Thorn Tree where you can put a posting on, which goes out into the ether to other travelers. And people can actually get back to you on your specific question. It's broken down by region, so you can actually head into the South Asia section, which covers Nepal, and say, can you recommend a great cycling company for cycle tour in Nepal?
Okay. I know you talked a little about safety concerns. Is that a big concern for that kind of tour or that kind of experience?
I think the traffic is probably more of an issue than the political situation for cycling, because the bus drivers have got a genuine death wish. They drive at incredible speeds and very little concern for the precarious 1,000-foot drop next to them. So it's important to sort of make sure you understand that the big vehicles have the right of way and you sort of get off the road when they want to go by.
Well, you know, that brings to memories my trip on the bus from Tonsen to Pokhara.
Oh, yeah. Tonsen's a fantastic place. It's one of my favorite towns in the Middle Hills.
I love Tonsen. There's something magical about it. I went there ages ago, and there was nothing important about it. It was just the first stop after the border, after Butwal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember going from this obscure Indian town, Gorakhpur, to Butwal, Butwal, and then from there, that's where you cross this ornate welcoming gate, welcome to Nepal, and your first stop is Tansen, and then all of a sudden you realize this is a magical little kingdom. Tell us about Tansen, Joe, and
Tansen was once a capital for one of the important sort of tribal groups who governed Nepal, and the last king of the kingdom gave it all up. He became a wandering ascetic monk, as we were talking about earlier, and eventually sort of vanished, but his royal sword and some of his sort of ceremonial items ended up in another town called Bandipur, and there's a legend that maybe he was murdered for his belongings. And so he went from being king to being a vagrant.
In a town like Tansen, just wandering around the town, the people that you encounter, it's like, who needs a museum? It's just, the culture is...
It is a living museum. The whole country is just... it's not being cleaned up or brushed up like would be, but it's there. People are still in the street hammering brass. They're still winnowing wheat next to the internet cafe.
And for us English speakers, the good news is I think English is the language of travel and the language of business, and they've got a fun way with their words. The signs are, I remember in the different display cases in a museum, it would say, keep yourself away instead of don't touch.
One of my favorites is the road signs. They have regular signs warning people about speed and dangerous driving because everyone drives so fast. And one of my favorite ones is, it is better to be Mr. Late than Late Mister.
Better to be Mr. Late than Late Mister. That's a classic Nepali English sign. I stayed at a hotel in Tansen, and the advertisement said, hotel for homely. Please get here.
Bless them. I mean, if we tried to write in Nepal, it would be even shockingly atrocious. I mean, they're doing an incredible job of working in English. But you do see some very sort of entertainment. Menu items are famous for sort of misspellings, which sometimes you spend like 20 minutes trying to look at what on earth is that?
There's a charm in Nepal. So, Craig, we got Craig on the line still in Wisconsin. I guess the tip is, remember, anybody can advertise anything, and you want to talk to other travelers who have experienced a trek. Lonely Planet has a great service at their website, lonelyplanet.com. It's called the Thorn Bush, right?
Thorn Tree.
Tell us the concept of a thorn tree. I know that it has something to do with sharing information on the road.
Well, I mean, originally it comes from Africa. There was a famous, I'm not sure this is exactly how it happened, but this happens in several African countries. There was a hotel in Nairobi in Kenya which had a physical acacia bush where people used to stick notes to each other on the thorns of the tree.
So it's kind of the grapevine.
Yeah, effectively, yeah. And so, I mean, what started off just people leaving paper notes to each other at this hotel became a digital thing where it's broken down into country and even sort of sometimes of regions of countries. And you can go to the section that interests you and just put a post and say, and some people say, I'm arriving on Wednesday. Does anyone want to meet up with someone to travel with? And other people want to find something really specific, like this company's been recommended to me. Is it any good? And other people want to... Yeah. Just sort of say, is anywhere new off the beaten track that's great to go to? So the people using it define the service. So we just provide a way for people to get together.
So it's even a service for people who happen to be in Nepal or Goa or Sri Lanka or whatever to connect and say, I'm going to be doing this. Do you want to join me?
Absolutely.
All right. Craig, does that help you out?
Yes, very much. Thank you.
Good luck on your travels.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm talking with Joe Bindlas, who's the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal. Joe, you mentioned seeing the artisans out there doing their traditional work, and what came to me is the town of Bhaktapur. It was my favorite town. It was just like a medieval wonderland, and it's just, an hour away from Kathmandu?
Well, there are three huge kingdom, independent city-states, effectively, in the same valley, and eventually Kathmandu became the most important, but Patan and Bhaktapur were the two rivals, and they're like slightly smaller versions of Kathmandu. They're the same amazing architecture. But they're repositories for traditional craft like brasswork, thangka painting, and ceramics. And again, they're sort of the living museums. And certainly the center of town is preserved as a sort of 17th century, 16th century medieval city. It's beautiful.
I'm a big sucker for open-air folk museums in Europe. And I walked into Bhaktapur and it seemed like, wow, this is just like an open-air folk museum with 10 times as many craftspeople doing their thing. And then it occurred to me, well, wait a minute. I don't think the government's sponsoring this.
No. I mean, there's an entry fee, but that's as far as the government goes. I mean, you are just walking around people doing what they do every day.
So this is the real thing.
Hundreds of years.
First of all, Durbar Square. Is that like the name of a main square in any town?
In the three large towns, each one of them has a Durbar Square. And it tends to be where the most important temples are located, where quite often, if there's a royal palace, it'll normally be.
Take me on a walk, Joe, and just what sort of artisans would I see doing their traditional work?
The way the cities are laid out, there's quite often little sort of sub-squares off the squares. So you walk past a tiny alley and it'll lead onto a large open square where people will be doing things. And the famous black pottery which comes from that area. So you'll see people with hand-powered or foot-powered treadmills turning on pottery wheels, making pots, leaving them to dry in the sun, and then taking them away into kilns. You'll see people making lost wax brass statues where they make a carving of wax, cover it in plaster, pour in molten brass and melt the wax away, and then chip the plaster off, which is, sort of, I think, sort of 300 BC, people were doing exactly the same thing.
Same exact thing. Is a perfectly timeless scene as far as I was concerned.
Yeah,
is a tourist with a camera welcome there?
Anyway, it pays to be respectful. I mean, the people do get a little bit sort of fatigued if people are always in their face, not being polite about it. I mean, if you raise your camera and ask for permission, people say yes or no, and most of the time people say yes. But if you do it without asking, people might get upset.
So that's sort of common good judgment in your travels, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have an email from Deanna in Renton, Washington. She traveled to Nepal for 3 weeks. She says, a friend told me I would never be the same after I returned, and it was true. The people there are dirt poor, but they have an extremely good attitude and almost always a smile on their face. The mountains are breathtaking. It's a beautiful comment. My memory is just beautiful people folding their hands together and bidding you a good day. They say, namaste. That means I salute your virtues.
If you can imagine walking down the street in New York or London and just saying hello to a stranger, I mean, you'd probably be shouted at or possibly arrested. Whereas,
and it's almost even more than a hello to a stranger, because the way they hold their hands together and they bow and they say, "I salute your virtues," right? Namaste.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a very humble concept, sort of to eye someone, to nod and bow. But it's big, and the sense of hospitality is incredible. As I mentioned earlier, when I was doing my big walk when I was younger. Quite often you turn up into a village, and very few foreigners might have come to that village before, but someone would just adopt you pretty much and say, come stay at my house. And you might not even speak the same language at all, but they'd like to come to the house and they'd put down a bed for you somewhere and make you some food without even any prompting.
Now, in a case like that, of course, they see dollar signs, don't they?
Well, no, it depends where you are. I mean, if you're on an established trekking route, people who live along there will have obviously become very dependent on tourism, so that might be the case there, but If you're off the beaten track, there's often quite the opposite. The people are just quite proud to have had a foreigner stay at their house, so they can sort of tell other people about it in the village.
I would think it'd be great for a traveler from the first world to bring some show-and-tell items, a Ziploc baggie full of postcards from their hometown and photographs
of
their family.
Things like that, yeah, definitely. But people are very interested in sort of how things are different different outside. And Nepal is very, very cut off, and was actually physically cut off for an incredibly long time. So the digital camera is a great one because if you have pictures of people back home or your home and things on the back, people are fascinated. But in a lot of places, the kids now expect to see digital cameras. If you have a normal camera, the kids are disappointed.
Ah, that's right. Instant photos for them. Hey, I'm talking with Joe Bindless. He's the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and right now we're in the rooftop of the world. We're in Nepal. Joe, let me just quickly go through some of the more touristic highlights for people. Adrenaline kicks. There's a lot of adventure sports all over the world. Tell me just briefly about, you know, whitewater rafting, tiger sighting, mountain flights, and so on.
Nepal has become an adventure playground. I mean, it helps that you've got this incredible sort of change of topography. I mean, you go from the plains, which are not far above sea level, to some of the highest peaks in the world. So river rafting is incredibly famous because not that many of the rivers are dammed for hydroelectric power yet in Nepal, whereas further downstream they often are. So there are many rivers which offer pretty much virgin rafting, and certain times of the year when the snow is melting and flooding the rivers, they become incredible torrents, and the rafting is absolutely spectacular.
What's the best season for whitewater rafting?
After monsoon, there's lots of water coming down. But you have to be sort of careful because sometimes if there's too much water, the rivers can burst their banks and it becomes a bit risky. So it's following, and it changes from year to year, sort of depending on how good a particular season will be. It will depend on how much rain there's been and how much melt-off there's been.
I doubt if I'll ever get to the Everest base camp, but I probably will get to Kathmandu and I'll have $100 for a sightseeing airplane ticket. Are there airplane flights?
It's a little bit spooky because the mountains are incredibly close. It's something inside doesn't feel quite right about flying towards mountains that directly. But then at the last minute you bank away and go along the side of them, and there they are. Just it feels like you could touch them. You're a few hundred yards away, just the highest mountains in the world.
So is this something you recommend as an excursion from Kathmandu?
It's it's great fun. But even walking the mountains, you'd be surprised how close you can get with surprisingly little effort. I mean, if you go to Pokhara, you can actually walk up. Even if you just do 2 days, two or 3 days, you can be across the valley from the proper of 7,000, 8,000 meter snow peaks.
So even a lightweight, you're saying if they hire a guide and get the right gear, they could go for a 2 or 3 day trek and really get some serious Himalayan thrills.
If you go up to Poon Hill from Pokhara, which is only a couple of days return trip, it's when it's clear, it has one of the best vistas in the whole Himalaya. They're all lined up.
Wow. I know that the Tibetan culture is to a great extent in exile. Is there still a chance for travelers to get a dose of Tibetan culture in Nepal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's in many ways, I mean, a lot of people say there's more Tibetan culture now in Nepal and also in parts of India than there is in Tibet because of the Chinese government's crackdown. So, I mean, the area around Bodhnath, which is a huge Buddhist stupa, it's a mini Lhasa. There are thousands of Tibetans living there, and many pilgrims are still coming across the mountains on pilgrimages, and they famously measure the distance out with the length of their own bodies, so they lie down facing Bodhnath, and then they stand up again, lie down one more time, stand up again, lie down again, for hundreds of miles across the mountains.
Really? Wow.
It's incredibly sort of dedicated, devoted religion.
So this is a mini Lhasa, meaning a mini cultural capital of Tibet,
yes.
Because Lhasa has basically been planted with Chinese, right, to sort of dilute
out.
The new
rail line is going to change things even more dramatically.
Does the Nepali government allow this Tibetan culture to thrive in an exile sort of state?
Well, it does. I mean, the main center of the Tibetan government in exile is Dharamshala in India, which is fairly close by. But within Nepal, Buddhism has always been kind of like the other religion. I mean, people have, even Hindus will often sort of venerate Buddhist deities, and the Tibetan form of Buddhism is a lot closer to Hinduism than, say, the Buddhism in Thailand or the Buddhism in of other parts of Southeast Asia.
Hmm. So Nepal is basically Hindu, but they have a lot of Buddhist flavor coming in mostly from Tibet.
Absolutely.
All right. Tell me about taste treats. You mentioned something called janla.
The most famous thing everyone sort of knows from Nepal is basically the Tibetan food, which is things like momos, which is it's kind of similar to a wonton. It's a rolled up sort of a flat flour case, which contains meat or often buffalo meat and vegetables. And they're sort of served up in steamers, and normally with a sort of spicy chili sauce to dip into them. And they're sort of great sort of warming food, particularly when you're sort of freezing up in the mountains.
Joe, as we talked about at the beginning, you were lured there by the sense of quiet, both inner and outer. And I think you can find that anybody who goes to Nepal, if they make a point, they can find that inner and outer quiet. Is there any lesson you've learned from your travels in Nepal that you actually bring back home with you and incorporate it into your life back in the first world?
Well, I think the thing we always try to bring back is that you see how little people need to be happy in countries like Nepal. And Nepal is a very good example of this. The people, they have very little money, they have very few possessions, yet they have a sort of sense of contentment in life, which most people in the West could only dream of. Their general day-to-day concerns are about physical things, but they're not sort of worrying about what's happening tomorrow. They're not sort of suffering the same kind of anguish about are they succeeding enough. They're having a sort of a very sort of a prosaic attitude to life. I think people's mental health in general feels a lot more healthy than it sometimes does in the West.
I found that so much in my travels that when you go to the poorer parts of the planet, you deal with people who operate from a mindset of abundance. And when you go to the richer parts of the world, you connect with people who operate from a mindset of scarcity. Going to Nepal, you can be inspired by people who really seem to be happy. And that's I think that's the most precious souvenir you can take home.
Absolutely. I mean, the children particularly. I mean, everywhere you go, you're mobbed by children who are just incredibly excited to sort of shake hands with a foreigner or to practice the limited English they picked up at school so far. And it's like a little bit like being a celebrity. You're always in demand when you go there.
Just thinking about Nepal and talking with you, it inspires me to travel and it makes me smile. Joe Bindless, who's the author of The Lonely Planet Guide to Nepal, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines. With their new Advantage Award booking tool, it's easier than ever to book to over 800 Advantage Award destinations online at aa.com. American Airlines knows why you fly.